Sirens just bring false alarms. We're lovers when they heed no call to arms. Will you still? Will you? Oh, will you still? Will you still be back?
Yeah. Now I'd like to welcome a guest in the studio. A live person's here, along with Free and Freer Freedom. This is Coral Reef. This is the show that you've tuned into tonight. The Tangerine Dream Team presents. Okay, what was that noise? Hey!
Way to go.
It's atmospheric. That was a drum crash, drum roll. Keith McHenry's here.
Dun, 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 dun. I don't know if you can hear that.
Founder of
Food. I heard it, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Keith has been lucky enough to find our station just as he rolled into town. He was kind enough to drive right up to the station, and now he's here.
Thanks for having me. That's so nice. I washed up on a reef.
Keith, you know, there's so much we could say about you. You still wear a hat and still. You got.
Less need for showers that way.
He's probably one of the few people that can cook a similar menu in so many different ways through so many different countries in so many different kitchens.
Yep, and non-kitchens, yes.
You have like a formula for that, don't you? Your organization, Food Not Bombs, has quite a menu that you're likely to, you know, demonstrate through your free schools and other places.
Yeah.
And is it also published anywhere? You know, what you're supposed to do if you wanted to start your own Food Not Bombs?
Yeah, on the foodnotbombs.net, there's originally the simple thing was the 7 steps to starting a Food Not Bombs, which gives you an idea of how to get started, and that's both a flyer and a page on foodnotbombs.net. And then there's an entire book, Hungry for Peace, which not only tells you, you know, like in immense detail how to collect the food, cook the food, recipes for 100, how to do it safely so no one gets ill, but also it gives you details on how to organize your own. Oh, bummer.
You too while you cook?
Right, yeah. So it is pretty amazing all the possible things that, like in the Food Not Bombs itself started stuff like homicide jails back in the 90s. It was between us and the tenants union, Ted and Gillickson, and then the first Homes Not Jails group. But also in 95, when we were preparing for the Food Not Bombs World Gathering in San Francisco, we started a project called Indie Media. Mm-hmm. And we had Indie Media workshops at the June 95 gathering that became established enough so that by the World Trade Organization protests in 99, there were IMCs all over the world able to report on what we were the protests in Seattle against the WTO. And you've had a local resident here, Heather Flores, that started a project called Food Not Lawns in Eugene, Oregon, when she was doing Food Not Bombs up there. So you have like a lot of spin-off things from from Food Not Bombs, and all that's in the Food Not Bombs book, Hungry for Peace.
Okay, well, I hear Freedom back there. What do you think of Food Not Bombs? You don't eat, so what do you do?
I don't eat free food.
Food
Only
Not Bombs.
Randomly selected food in supermarkets.
But the power behind Food Not Bombs is not in the food, it's not in the bombs, it's in the
Well, it's in the people, for sure. The idea is that, you know, when I was starting Food Not Violence with my seven friends, one of the things that happened was I was a produce worker at Bread and Circus, and this was one of the first kind of commercial natural foods, sort of like a Whole Foods type of thing. And I felt horrible. We were throwing away all this food, so we started taking it to the projects, and across the street from the projects was a place where they designed nuclear weapons.
Mm-hmm.
And it was because of that we chose the name Food Not Bombs. That and some graffiti we were doing around town.
All right. Yeah, you came in April.
Someone may have been doing around town.
And you gave a whole talk on all this.
You came up with a name? Who came up with the name?
Well, it was, the graffiti was Money for Food, Not for Bombs. And we had actually a couple of experimental names before that. We had one was Food for Free Committee. And if you look in the Food Not Bombs book at the beginning, there's a thing where you can see an early flyer where it does say Food Not Bombs, We Never Sell Out. And then it says, sponsored by Food for Free Committee. But eventually we thought, wow, it made a lot more sense to call ourselves Food Not Bombs, because we'd had problems in Clamshell Alliance where people thought we were a clamming organization and didn't realize we were trying to stop a nuclear power station. So we thought, wow, we should have a name that actually says what it is we're trying to do. So when you said the name, you got the idea of what it was we're trying to do. Mm-hmm. So that's where we came up with that.
That's good advertising.
Yeah. And it's kind of been kind of confusing, though, in the past, too, because I find journalists often just think it's a
peace movement,
like a phrase, and it's not a group, and therefore they don't identify us in the media.
How do you relate the name of the group to what you do presently and currently?
Well, the basic problem in society that we saw even in 1980 when we started was that there's this huge amount of money going to the military while people are going hungry. And so if you're talking about national security, it doesn't make any sense to have lots of starving, hungry people in your country, yet you have all these huge, weapon systems and nuclear bombs and all that. So today it's even worse than it was back in 1980, where, you're about to face huge cuts in SNAP or food stamps. You know, there's a lot of talk about Congress cutting that. There's even been a proposal to ban people who've ever been convicted of a felony from ever getting SNAP. Stuff like that. So there's national priorities where the money is put into to things like a huge military buildup. I know right now Obama administration's making these new nuclear bombs for Europe, and we're not really supposed to be at war with the Soviet Union, which doesn't even exist anymore. But yet we're spending all that money on that, and at the same time cutting the budgets for food stamps and stuff that people need.
Well, maybe they could load up the drones with burritos and they could deliver those.
That's a funny thing. Well, there is a funny thing. What part of the selling of drones is to is the idea to spend money on, say, oh well, drones are benign because there's going to be. Pizza Hut's going to use them to deliver pizzas. So, or maybe the drones can be used to put out forest fires, so there'll be like 8 drones putting out forest fires and 800,000 drones spying on your neighbor.
Really?
So
there is those, so you can sign up for those programs? Because I'd like to get a cop watch on a drone program, because everybody's kind of scared to face the cops because they arrest you when you cop watch them.
Well, it's a possibility. I mean, there have been some. There was a Occupy, Occupy Wall Street used a drone to actually figure out where the riot police were hiding behind buildings
stuff.
Cool. Yeah. But the it's estimated that there's going to be, 30,000 police drones over the United States. And there's counties and towns which have a petition drive like we do in Taos, New Mexico, to try to get a laws passed that the towns or counties will not accept money from Homeland Security to buy local police drones, because that's something that in the Obama administration's really trying to push right now. So we have a campaign for that. And another thing that's happening in New Mexico is that they're practicing the invasion of Iran with these Osprey jets, these kind of helicopter plane type of vehicles that crash frequently. And we're starting to see those going up and down the Rio Grande Gorge, even though supposedly the policy hasn't been implemented yet, but it looks like they're sort of sneaking them in anyway. So you have all that money going to stuff like that, while at the same time, you know, you have this huge amount of people, you know, just struggling to find food. And there's cases where recently where I met people that hadn't eaten in 5 days.
Because and yet you're getting hassled for giving people food just for being there and doing it because you can. And they don't like you to do that because you have food, huh?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, there's, I think, you know, it's an interesting thing. In Taos, they just gave us a notice violation because we didn't have a permit. And we told the kind people that we didn't really need a permit. That's that the First Amendment was our permit.
Right. That's right. That because of the name of your group.
Right. And the idea that the government will either give you or withhold your permit, depending upon
the content of what you're saying.
Yeah. Yeah. Then
which they'll deny. No, it's not content-based. We just don't want to give you a permit.
Right. And but they'll give Salvation Army a permit or somebody else a
the
permit.
The Girl Scouts or something.
Yeah, but not Food Not Bombs.
Exactly.
So.
But they won't give you a reason why.
Because if it's content-based, and they're under strict scrutiny, and they're in trouble. So they always say, like for the singing here, when you got they got popped, it was, oh, it's nothing to do with what we were saying, yet they never arrest the Girl Scouts for singing out there.
Right, yeah, it's definitely the message. And, you know, an interesting thing, which I'm still trying to get a hold of a copy of this, is I happen to be on tour, and I happen to see twice a C-SPAN lecture of the State Department. Two State Department officials at the Fletcher School of Diplomacy, this was in April of 2009, where they were comparing the people that shared the free vegan meals in the parks to Al-Qaeda, and they're wanting to know which was more dangerous, Al-Qaeda or Food Not the people with the vegan meals. And what they said was that the vegan meal people had been around almost 30 years, and that Al-Qaeda had only been around 20, that they expected the kids with the vegan meals would be around another 30, and that the, what made them more dangerous than Al-Qaeda was that they were convincing the American public to think money should be diverted from military spending towards education and health care.
We're speaking with author and originator, founder of Food Not Bombs, Keith McHenry, here live in the studio, June 4th, 2013. Meek Coral Reef with Free of Freedom. Keith, how do you think that danger will make a difference in serving food? Does it feel good to have dangerous feeling about it?
Oh, you know, at one time I was really pretty interesting until I personally started facing life in prison. That didn't made things kind of nerve-wracking. Mm-hmm. And I have to say, even the more recent thing, even though it's like likely to blow over, it's a little irritating to have a notice, you know, notice of violation. And the only reason it's nerve-wracking is that a lot of other things are happening right now, which give me the impression that something's up with the government. Mm-hmm. And they're concerned about some other larger mega disaster, and they're just trying to prepare the community for that. And one of the things they're doing is trying to keep activists busy with stupid things like this. Mm-hmm. And I've noticed I've been getting a lot of like email smear campaigns stepped up. A lot of people that hadn't been in my community have returned and started harassing me. So there's a you know, I don't know whether it's just because we are having the founding of the free school and it's really taking off and people are
this is in Taos?
In Taos. Mm-hmm. Or if it's something like a war with Syria or an economic crash or something like that, where, and I'd be interested to see if other activists are starting to have the same patterns again. I know years about, right before the Republican National Convention, Democratic Conventions in 2008, you know, the Food Not Bombs bank account, all the money disappeared that was put in from lectures. And in fact, it was overdrawn, and the phone stopped ringing. The Food Not Bombs website went from $50 a month to $1,000 a month. All these weird things started happening.
Wow!
And then I was listening to Tom Hartman around that time, and it turned out Naomi Wolf. Exactly the same pattern happened to her, and I started checking it out. And it turned out that In June, before the convention, all these different weird things started happening to lots of activists, including Funabombs in Minneapolis. Mm-hmm. Had like a woman join Funabombs there that looked just exactly like my former wife, who was my age and who just loved dumpster diving and just got a divorce and blah, blah, blah. And it turned out Rita Mae was actually working for the government and was an informant. And when... you know, and was there just to disrupt the Funabombs, and it turned out that a bunch of people
and she did.
How did she disrupt?
What techniques did she use? So we can watch for it in the future.
Well, that was interesting. So what she did was she joked about bombing the police and bombing the Republicans at meetings, and the other three informants attending the meetings also would all be together. Yeah. Let's, you know, we should do this and that. And the Funabombs kids, being younger, were kind of shy, and they didn't really comment on it. And it turned out that when they took the tapes of the informants at the meetings and they typed them as transcripts, they didn't make it clear who was saying bombing this, bombing that. So they didn't have that air of humor in the typed transcripts. So then the prosecuting attorney could go to the judge and get a warrant for a raid on the Funabombs house, mm-hmm, based on these threats.
But you can, you know, find out who those informants are and then tie them to the comments and then sue the fucking government for all the harassment.
Well, it turned... Yeah, I don't know how well the suing the government part of it...
It's got to be in federal. It won't work in the New Mexican state.
Well, in this case, this was both... It was a fusion center that was involving both the federal government and the state of Minnesota. And eight people, which became the RNC-8, were charged under the Minnesota Patriot Act for this. And it turned out that the Republican National Committee had actually provided $50 million to the state to get them to be involved in doing this campaign against the RNC Welcoming Committee and the Funabombs activists. So, unfortunately, in my experience of all the different lawsuits that we've had, you know, right now we have Jeremy Hamden is in federal jail in Manhattan. He's pleading guilty to passing files to WikiLeaks about private intelligence operations through Stratford files. He was a Chicago Funabombs volunteer. You have Eric McDavid, who was framed by a woman by the name of Anna, who I'd had horrible experiences with through the several years she was in Funabombs, but had, you know, I just thought she was like an annoying person, didn't really get that she was an informant until actually she testified in court. So all these informants came forward because of the necessity of them testifying in trials.
Exactly.
So,
you know, there's an easy solution to the informant problem. You just have everybody that's part of your organization sign declarations that they do not work for law enforcement at any level, signed under penalty of perjury the laws of that state. Therefore, when they testify in court, you just bring out that document and say, well, you lied on this document. How do we know you're not lying now? And that's a felony.
Huh, you know, that's an interesting idea.
It's a very simple thing to do.
That is interesting. Maybe that should happen. The problem, I think, when you do that...
People get nervous. They don't want to sign anything.
Yeah, and then also, it's kind of this funny double-edged sword where the law enforcement community wants people to be paranoid that there are people spying on you. But at the same time, there are people spying on you.
That's right.
So it's more of the, you know, what I say in the book Hungry for Peace, I have a little section called What to Do to Avoid Being Prosecuted for Terrorism. And what I urge people to do, and this is what Eric didn't do because Eric is kind of a shy, quiet person, is to very vocally say, no, I will not be bombing or doing an arson every time the informant suggests that you do it. Yeah.
But then you start talking about that. That's how we get in trouble. That's agent provocateurs are doing this. Maybe you're an agent provocateur, you know.
Correct. Yeah. You don't even need to accuse it, but I think you're right. You just say, well, this is what in the past when, you know, and you could see like with the Daniel McGowan, there's been this whole thing since about 1997, 98, which is a recurrence of a pattern that we saw like in the 70s of like the diversity of tactics. We must be open to it. And so what sounds like a,
that's,
you know,
bullshit,
a black bloc thing that's like kind of not that big a deal, the what people often don't realize is that gets morphed into, you know, to the way the media portrays it and the FBI and the courts, black bloc action and, you know, threatening to bomb a bridge in Cleveland are essentially the same thing, you know, to, even though, you know, we might compartmentalize it in our minds as being different shades of you know, escalation of strategy or something, but that just isn't the way it gets presented in in courts and in the media. And
you lose public support the minute you go
you
the
really
direction.
Do. Yeah. I had a, like an argument with a guy.
Here with Occupy, same
yeah,
thing.
Occupy all over America. You could see that. Well, in those documents that came out about Occupy were pretty fascinating. Where they at one on page 61, that was through what the Partnership for Justice or something like that. I forget the name of the organization, but they had, you know, they showed they were, somebody was discussing using suppressed sniper rifles to kill the alleged leadership of Occupy.
I know, I ran that quote. It was a Russian TV or something had it.
Yeah, RT had that. It was actually in the, I mean, I found it in the actual documents that were released by the FBI.
So which groups were, you saw that, well, which groups were trying to kill the Occupy?
Well,
was
it
the FBI?
It was redacted and it made it unclear, but it was an FBI document talking about that somebody was.
Within the government, right?
It could have been a, it was made vague enough that it could have been like a right-wing group that was being promoted by the FBI. We've seen that where, you know, there, you know, the Greensboro massacre was FTA, fire, tobacco, or, you know, whatever FTA stand for in those days, alcohol, tobacco, and firearms. And they were, the guy that pulled the gun and pointed it at the protesters was a Fed. He never pulled the trigger, but the Ku Klux Klan that showed up with him did pull the trigger, and they killed a bunch of protesters. So you could have been just that was the idea, where an informant was going to talk up how evil the occupiers were, get some right-wing group to show up out there and, you know, encourage them to shoot at people and then have them shoot at people. You just don't, it could, or it could have been a government agency, you know, like Delta Force or something that was just going to go out with suppressed sniper rifles and shoot perceived, you know, organizers, you know. So, I know I got hassled a lot through Occupy. I was stopped on my way into Chicago on the 16th of September by a highway patrolman in rush hour traffic on Interstate 55. And he ended up just asking me what I thought about different wars, about the Vietnam War, and was I a vet, and did I do this, and do, you know, what did I think about World War One, World War Two, Korean War. It was really weird. And then he never gave me a ticket or anything, and just told me to go. And then a couple of days later, I got pulled over again, and I got pulled over basically every 3 days while I was
in Chicago.
Well, I actually right from Chicago after I set up a kitchen there, I went to Wall Street. I was. I stopped on the way to Wall Street. I stopped when I left Wall Street on my way to Washington, D.C. to set up the McPherson Square kitchen. Then I was, you know, in the Freedom Plaza kitchen. Then I was harassed in Philadelphia. And then I was harassed on my way to Poughkeepsie. And I was harassed on my way to Boston. And I was ultimately arrested right after Boston for a warrant from 1983. For posting flyers in Cambridge against the war in El Salvador. But, so, yeah, you, it's...
isn't there a statute of limitations on that? I mean,
isn't that weird that that... Well, the weird thing that was happening was on the news at that time, there was a whole big discussion about how that those sports figures were having sex with boys in the locker room, and they were let go because of statute of limitations. But because I had been charged with putting up the flyer within the 7 years, I was still...
This is Pennsylvania?
Well, I was a bus in Massachusetts. Yeah, but that was at
those kids were coming from a Freemason orphanage, by the way.
Yeah, and that was really somehow that was not illegal, but posting a flyer against the war in El Salvador was.
That all got big in the news right when Occupy was happening to divert attention. They're not above molesting little children in order to prove their political point, and yet if you give away food, you're a villain.
Yeah,
a terrorist.
It is really, really interesting. I do wonder what is up. What kind of because I started to wonder about 30 days ago. A bunch of people returned to Taos who had been involved in the in disrupting the Taos Peace House, which crashed due to a total bunch of really crazy things that went on with that, and then the seven people that destroyed the Peace House sent me a letter censoring me and kicking me out of the peace movement forever, which was word for word the same letter that I'd received in after the Unfree Trade Tour, where I was kicked out of Funabombs forever. And it was weird that...
Didn't you start it?
Yeah. I was never allowed to say that I designed the... the letter told, said I'd been permanently censored. I could not say I started it. I could not say I designed the logo. I could not say anything about my participation
now,
in Funabombs.
Why is this? Because someone might misconstrue you as a leader.
Well, this is what...
Violated anarchist rule number one.
Leader. Well, that's another funny thing is I started getting all this like hate mail recently, about all kinds of crazy things. Like the one that is the most classic is that I'm a millionaire. That I the reason Funabombs is vegetarian is that I sold all the meat to buy this mansion in Marin County. And so and somebody just recently told me they knew me and that I'd done that. And I went into great detail about how I stole all the meat and sold it, and now I'm rich. And he knew Keith McHenry, and he's telling me this, not knowing who I am. It was really funny.
It's like this idiot. Like, I saw a thing on post on Yahoo that said LSD causes chromosome damage. I mean, that was disproved, over 45 years ago. People still keep these idiot ideas in their heads forever.
Yeah, it is really funny. I know. I was in Dallas, Texas, and a guy announced I was going to speak at the garage, and a guy standing next to me said, "Oh, I know that Keith McHenry. Yeah, he's sold the meat and owns the." And I was like, "Wow, man, this is rumors really getting around. It's really amazing." So that all has resurfaced again, and so you do get this. So that kind of thing was happening right before the RNC in 2008.
So you're expecting something big is going to happen here because you're getting hassled again.
Yeah, because, you get all... Like, I posted something on Facebook, like, when I got... I posted that article about the Mark Zuckerman or whoever the dude is that invented it.
Yeah.
About how he was...
Zuckerberg,
and how he was paying for the a pro-Exxon Keystone pipeline campaign and all this right-wing nonsense, right? Mm-hmm. So I said, wow, we need to make our own better Facebook and get it out there. And I ended up with all these messages about how I'm just out there trying to, get rich, on Facebook. And I'm like, really? By posting a thing about this dude that, and suggesting that we have our own, free Facebook equivalent that we do ourselves? And, in the anarchist community actually invented, Indie Media, these people out of Australia before the Seattle action came up with self-publishing software for Indie Media. And now, of course, that's been used by all kinds of people, including Facebook, So, it's pretty interesting. Interesting. A group of anarchists in BC are the ones invented a secure, payment on the internet.
Is that Bitcoin?
Well, no, this is way before that. This is what now we call PayPal and that, right? Yeah. That was invented by a bunch of activists up in British Columbia or in like 93, 94, in the early part of the web.
Well, this whole country was invented by activists.
That's right.
Yeah. It was a revolution, baby.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So it's pretty funny how these people identified themselves as anarchists that invented this stuff. So it's pretty funny. And then you get people like Mark Zuckerberg.
Are you an anarchist?
Eco-anarcho-terrorist.
That's right. Well, yeah, I am. Well, I was a...
How do you deal with the infiltrators when you're using consensus?
Insurgents.
Well, you know, the reason we came to the idea of using the consensus process was because we were in a group. I was in a group called Boston Alliance Against Registration of the Draft. And
when was this?
And that would have been in the 70s. After when Carter was proposing to bring back Selective Service after the Vietnam War, and the and so doing that, we I was in this group, and there was all this joking about getting arms and guns for the revolution, and in those days you didn't have email, but you had like phones, so we called all the people that had come to meetings and asked them why they weren't coming to meetings, and overwhelmingly people said, well, you know, I'm against war, that's why I'm against the draft and Selective Service. And I'd go to the meetings and there'd be all this talk about guns for the revolution. So I went to this to a meeting, and my friend Frank Aflito and myself, and we said, why don't we propose that we will call everyone up and say we're not going to joke about guns for the revolution for 6 weeks. So the next week all these people showed up to the meeting who we had never met before, and they voted to continue talking about guns for the revolution. So I step outside I leave the meeting, go outside, and on my way home, where I get arrested for wheat pasting. It turned out that one of the people
advocating was a provocateur.
Yeah, well, it turned out all but Frank and I were FBI.
All but them. Yeah. All but you.
You got to start charging dues, baby. Yeah, then you can profit off the FBI.
It was really crazy.
Yeah.
We have a special policy here. It's not really official, but anybody from law enforcement can join the collective, but it's $600,000 to join.
Per month. Right.
Yeah. To cover potential legal costs, right, allowing law enforcement in here.
Yeah. It's like really crazy, the kind of things that go on.
I couldn't get that through consensus, by the way.
No. It was blocked by one of the cops.
Exactly.
If you wonder if we're here, yes, we are live, and this is Tangerine Dream Team Hour. Speaking with Keith McHenry and For Your Freedom, and host Coral Reef here.
Now, the suppression has gone farther than, you get beaten up regularly, right?
Well, I haven't fortunately been beaten up in a while, but I do, in San Francisco, I was beaten. Oh, I think I counted 13 times on the streets by cops. I was hit with flashlights. I was hit with batons. My skull was broken. And
any of it caught on tape?
And some caught on tape.
What happened with that?
All my cases have been thrown out.
Because of?
Well, there was a great case. And then so the evidence was found inadmissible. By the evidentiary judge. He actually asked me and my attorney in an elevator how my case was going, and my lawyer, Dennis Cunningham, the person that also did the Judy Berry, Daryl Turney case, it was like, well, not so well, because we can't show the evidence. So what happened was I was on October 15th of 1989, I was beaten up and arrested and charged with throwing police barricades at a line of riot police. But there was turned out to be this woman, Ellen, who happened to take video of the guy throwing the barricades. And it wasn't me. It was an undercover cop dressed in the same clothing as me. And then that cop goes through the crowd and he starts pointing out people that are supposed to be the organizers to have them arrested. They get arrested. Then you hear the people screaming and yelling behind the guy, and the camera swings, and there I've got six cops throwing me on the ground, beating the crap out of me. And then,
is this up on YouTube anywhere?
A little bit of it is. It's a little longer than can be on YouTube, unfortunately, unless I do something to extend my ability to be on it. But the so then what happens after that is I'm in another civil case. I get a bunch of files, 700, 800 pages of documents, maybe even more. And we're going through the health department documents, and we come across some police department documents. And in that, it turns out there's a wiretap memo about this incident, but in advance. So there's a September 27th wiretap memo, which you can see online if you Google Food Not Bombs wiretap. And And it on that wiretap memo, it discusses, it says that they got my home phone number. That turns out they got it between when I was speaking to, with Starhawk at a meeting in Berkeley.
Mm-hmm.
And they talk about a conversation I actually have with another Food Not Bombs co-founder who's looking for a house to stay in, but they paint it as we're in alliance with these other groups and blah, 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 and I'm bringing 3,000 people more than ever before to this rally. But I actually hadn't lived in San Francisco the year before, so I don't know how I was doing this.
Mm-hmm.
And so it turned out they had been, and then the head of police intelligence actually had asked me a question in 850 Bryan Street, but I didn't know who he was. He was just a guy in a suit, and he would ask me, "Oh, what's your plans for October 15th? And I'm like, "Well, I don't have any plans," because they didn't have any plans. And so anyway, we had all that evidence, a wiretap without a warrant, video of the undercover cop being dressed just like me doing the crime for which I then get beat up for, and I even had one friend on the jury, which is very unusual.
Yeah.
And I still could not win the case because of the way state law was, and because I couldn't.
It's the state law case.
In that case, it was state law.
You got to always be in federal.
Yeah, but I haven't won federal ever. I had 15. So I've had 15 civil rights lawsuits in federal court. I've had the only one I won was my own case where my dog was. My two dogs were chased off a cliff at.
The cops killed your dogs?
They didn't die, but their legs were broken.
Oh, man.
And I was jailed for and beaten up during that. And I got Thelton Henderson as the judge in the original case, and it went to the settlement judge. Turned out to be Claudia Wilkins, who was the one that heard the Free Radio Berkeley case and heard the Judy Berry, Daryl Turney case. And I got into an argument with her during the settlement case. So there's a time where... So the park police had gone out and put up a giant sign saying, "No dogs off leash, no parking."
Mm-hmm.
6 months after I'd been arrested.
And they brought they used that in evidence?
And they brought that in to show that I'd been... You know, there's a giant sign there and I should have known. I fortunately had photos from the day after I got out of jail. Plus,
that's always get your evidence early.
Yeah. And from six, and the public federal public defenders had photos, so we show that. And I can hear them laughing. Claudia's in there laughing with the park police about what a jerk it is that we bring in lawsuits for broken leg, you know, dog legs and stuff. And so I can hear through the door this is going on. So I go in and I go, "Look, you saw the Rodney King uprising and stuff like that. People are going to get sick
people
of
love
us.
Pats, man. That's
yeah. And they're not going to put, and also they're not going to put up with police lying." He said, "Look, you're supposed to be a federal magistrate, and these guys lied to you, and yet you're buddy with them. While you know,
it's all conspiracy. Like I said earlier, we should form our own court system of the people and go after these, because they're not going to be tried in the regular courts ever.
Oh no, no. I mean,
it's a DA's discretion. It's my buddy. I'm not going to try him."
Yeah. I mean, I've been trying to get rehabilitated for years, and I even had a district attorney for a friend. You know, I Mr. Hallinan had come out and risked arrest serving food for us, and when he was a DA, I couldn't get. He just didn't have the time to. Mm-hmm. You know, to clean up my case. So now when I travel in and out of the country, I have to take all these papers that prove that I'm no longer, wanted and all this stuff. And it's just really crazy. So, yeah, there's it's easy to get yourself in trouble for nothing, but getting out of it is another whole thing. And I have to say, I would try never to get in federal court and sue somebody anymore. It's just so much. I spent... $40,000 on that got nothing.
Mm-hmm. Well, I wouldn't spend it, give him any money, but that's why you should always sue if you're destitute.
Well, yeah, well, that was $40,000 in Xeroxing. That wasn't, we had free lawyers and everything. We just spent $40,000 in nothing. You know, we had all free attorneys, we were paupers.
Which district?
And that was in the, San Francisco District.
Ninth District.
I wasn't even allowed to go to my own case or the you know, in the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. Mm-hmm. They wouldn't let me in.
I noticed that all the legal decisions for homeless sleeping and everything, it's obvious you have a right to sleep, and yet they completely ignore it.
Yeah. And we had occasionally, you'll get a good judge, like in Florida, we had a guy say that, look at the message of Food Not Bombs is protected speech, and mm-hmm. that it's the right to share food in public with banners and literature.
Conduct can be communicated.
Yeah, and it was a really beautiful ruling on his part, but then it went to the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals in Atlanta, and they ruled that time, place, and manner, that the city can limit you to twice a year.
You know? But that's not an adequate alternative, is always the response. Yeah, they use time, place, and manner here as if it was magic, but that it still has to be adequate, the alternative that they offer. And if it's twice a year is not adequate for getting your message out.
Right, twice a year to talk about, and it turned out in Orlando, what I discovered later was, first think it was about tourism and Disney and stuff, but it turned out Lockheed was the largest mm-hmm. company.
Employer,
they weren't the largest employer, but the largest amount of money. They said only something like Disney had 50,000 employees.
There's contributed very little to the local community in terms of
right,
money,
and then Lockheed had about five thousand employees, but made many times more money than Disney World in the same county. It was kind of interesting, and so
it's more money in bombs,
yeah,
than mice and ducks.
And it was interesting how they conceal even the local authorities try to make it out to be an issue of tourism. Because they were no way they wanted people to actually connect Lockheed Martin's, influence in local politics mm-hmm. to the case of Food Not Bombs. So.
This sounds like a good time for a music break.
Cool.
So we can maybe take a nap. Oh, yeah. We're listening to 101.3 FM. Call us 427-3772. Tuned in to the Tangerine Dream Team Show. Talking. Don't let me interrupt you.
No problem. You're the host. You don't have to interrupt me.
As you were saying, Mickey Mouse, Donald Duck, tourists.
Well, there's a great Santa Cruz connection to Mickey Mouse and Donald Duck and that whole thing.
You got one here, too.
It was one of your local library patrons. Well, it's funny. I end up in jail, and I got a judge that was somehow personally involved in the case, so he wouldn't let me out, wouldn't let me post bail. And
where's this?
And that was in Florida, in Orlando.
Okay. Right.
And then I'm stuck in this really. They have the state law that or rule that the jails have to be 53 degrees.
Were you one of many arrested?
There's 23 arrests in all, and I was two. There was 24 arrests total, and I was two of them. I ended up doing 17 days the second time.
Second time.
Yeah, I did 2 days the first time.
And was this a sweep that got a lot of people all at once, or is it over the few years?
No, it's just they would arrest two or three of us at each meal.
Is this when Anonymous and our local Commander X was...
Yeah, Commander X started posting stuff on all these websites. And so I don't even know what's going on, and I get... because I'm in jail, and I couldn't call out, because there's also this problem you can't call out in Florida.
Okay.
Because if it's a cell phone... You have to go through this whole thing through Walmart and this whole crazy thing to call out. So I could never call anybody. So I had no idea what was happening on the outside. And occasionally somebody would have seen the news and would give me some, you know, some new inmate would tell me something. But then all of a sudden I get all these requests of interview with the media. And I'm like, okay, I'll interview with the media. I want to find out what's happening. So I go and interview with the media. And they go, well, how are you organizing the disruption of all these websites from in jail? You know? And I said, don't you think this is terrorism? And, you know, you've done millions of dollars worth of damage to the local economy, and people can't even have vacations here now because of you. And it was like this whole funny thing. And I'm like, wow, what's happening with that? That was, like, really crazy. And it turned out because of that, we ended up on the BBC and on Democracy Now. If it wasn't for Commander X, we would just been a bunch of people getting arrested for serving food and no one would have cared, you know? And I was like, it's really amazing. So I started a bunch of New Food on Bonds chapters behind that. It was really funny. And
thank you, Commander.
Yeah.
Go, Chris.
God, that was really positive.
Anonymous.
This is not evidence. No one knows he had anything to do with it.
No, it's really funny. And then you hear, and to find out it was from Santa Cruz, and somebody was...
Wow, we're suspicious. Yeah, all of a sudden, Anonymous moved towards homeless issues.
Yeah, right.
Chris may have been involved.
He started on the East Coast, too.
Yeah, it was...
Oh,
really,
no, we don't know.
We don't really know, and we don't know where he went. But
it's in Canada, come on.
So that was... It was so beautiful. That was really quite an amazing experience. But the... yeah, I think, you know, if it wasn't for that, that would have been... There were, like, protests all over the world. I don't know how well they got covered, but we did get video from Detroit, from Philippines, from Milan, stuff like that, about people just doing solidarity actions for...
What kind of food did they serve in a jail?
Oh, my God, that was horrible. It was brown stuff, and it was, like...
In Florida, 53 degrees.
Yeah, it was horrible. Oh, my God. And, you know, it was... To get the only book I was able to get was a book by the 700 Club about this woman that converted to Christianity after she had hacked up like 30 people or something and was on death row. And, God, it was a nightmare in there. And that was also, I mean, half the people in there were for, you know, for OxyContin, and they run these, like, scams where they have pain clinics. And you can't, and one dude, he hadn't been able to eat. There are people that have been there 18 months, hadn't
Who's
been
running
before
the scams?
A judge.
You mean the government?
The government, yeah. Actually, Scott Walker and them have...
How do this, they work? What are they?
Well, they run these... they put billboards all over the South and advertise the 1-800-PAIN, and then you drive down there to go to a pain clinic because you're injured or whatever. Mm-hmm. And then it turns out that they write you a prescription. You think you're seeing a doctor, and then you go to CVS across the street to get your medicine. You get the medicine, you walk out the door, and the police arrest you, and it's so many years per pill, and they figure out how many you know. So,
and it's on billboards.
Yeah, it's on billboards on the highways.
What is
the ads
Some
for
scam.
The pain clinics? And it's all run by Scott Walker.
He's
the governor. He runs this like whole clinic system for pain management. And so, it's the entire thing is like
this is where
Florida. So the whole, and he gets a cut of every prisoner.
You hear that, Rick? Rudabaker?
Yeah, it's really...
Yeah, he makes money coming and going.
Yeah, it's an entire scam. And that's how he funded his campaign to run for governor.
That's kind of what's happening in a larger sense in this whole country. I mean, the Republicans, with their economic policies, put everyone out of work, crashed the economy. The left trying to occupy, but the really, really, if you look back at the 30s, there were left demonstrations, but there were also far-right Nazi demonstrations. So the same right that's fucking took all our money now tries to take away all our freedoms by getting rid of posse comitatus and going into our homes and taking our guns and everything else.
Oh, yeah. If you look on my Facebook, I just posted that... it turns out, like, in the last week, there's a... this has been happening for a while, but I found a U.S. federal government document, which I put on my wall, about Yeah, that the military is now has got this whole coordination with state and local.
Yeah, militarizing the police. Yeah.
Yeah, and that they're supposed to. It's
happened up in Washington or some peace group they infiltrated, and he got on their listserv. We got everybody.
Oh, you know what? That's really frightening. That was Olympia Funat Bombs.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And so one of the kids in Olympia Funat Bombs happened to go to the city hall, and he was able to get these documents. Found out his friend, who was the one inputting all the. Data for, you know, like if you joined Olympia Funat Bombs, this guy would take your name and phone number and input it.
Exactly. And that's another place where you look for snitches right where they want to be.
Yeah, right, yeah. And he had brought the reason Larry Hillerson, who did a Free Radio Berkeley lawsuit, he was one of the lawyers in that, what turned out to be his lawyer, and they said, oh yeah, the military can do that because they're part of a fusion center. And it's like, oh yeah, you're part of a fusion center than the, but this document today actually makes it even further. You don't have to be a part of a fusion center or anything. The military intelligence is allowed to, according to this executive order that's through the DOD, it's allowed to help coordinate the infiltration and spying on dissidents in the United States.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And that was, and they even explained that posse comitatus. This is not deal with posse comitatus. This is an exemption. An exemption, and we're allowed to do whatever we want.
We're allowed to come in and take away their guns.
Yeah.
If you'd like to talk to Keith, call in 831-427-3772 right now.
Cool.
Good luck with that.
Well, yeah. We're streaming, though. We're streaming. So any of you over there in the Philippines that might be listening.
Isn't that cool? When I was in the Philippines, they were, like, asking me questions about, you know, some of my collective members do this thing called Dan the Pandarkist puppet show. Mm-hmm. And they have all these YouTube videos of their puppet shows. And they all have been faithfully watching all these YouTube videos of the Dan the Pandarkist puppet shows in the Philippines. It's really a trip.
There you go.
Yeah. And then when I went to Indonesia, too, during that trip, it blew my mind. There was a... over 100 Funat Bombs chapters in Indonesia. That's a freak out.
It's an easy franchise. It's very spread.
Yeah, and they were so bold. Some of the stuff, they were, God, it was such an honor, man. The people that would, this one, the, I went to this one presentation, and I had such a hard time getting there. I missed my train, and I ended up having to take, like, the economy bus, and I was, like, 6 hours late. But it was, it turned out, you know, they had one of the Funat Bombs chapters was raising money in town to get truckloads of water to go up in the mountains and fill all these, like, reservoirs with water for local people.
Oh, that's great.
And, yeah, it was just, and to help them with their farming and stuff. Mm-hmm. And it was just huge. And then another group was stopping a concrete factory in another town. Yaya, he ended up with my host in one community, and he had done 6 months in jail for fighting mining in Papua New Guinea. And there's a huge war going on with, in behalf of the United States and European and Chinese companies in Papua New Guinea, where they're, like, killing and torturing, like, thousands of people right now. It's not even on the radar. Mm-mm. And there's another thing called, I just had a communications this morning with a guy from Medan, Indonesia, and they're the ones that brought to my attention this thing called the Indonesian Master Plan, which is from the Boston Consulting Group in 1 Beacon Street in Boston, and they're building train lines all over Indonesia to extract coal and gold and logging, massive logging and stuff, and they're making super ports on the coast. Mm-hmm. And then they're designating Bali and a couple of islands around Bali as tourist islands, so you can land in Bali and think that you're in this wonderful
paradise,
but the islands like Java next door being completely strip mined, and it's really hardcore. So the Funat Bombs kids there were doing amazing things. That was in the Philippines. They were doing every single chapter had this idea that you started out by having this breakfast of smooth tofu with sugar cane, And then after you, all the kids ate that, they would do an art class, and everyone would draw pictures, and they'd put them up all on the wall somewhere, and then they'd all discuss them. It was in self-empowerment of the young people. And then they'd have a music class after that, and then they would have the big dinner, and they would spend the whole day doing this.
Interesting.
And it was all in some very high... public, you know, it'd be just like doing it at the post office here, you know. So, you know, where everybody walking by and you were bringing in the people. It was just amazing. And that happened in, there's like 30 cities in the Philippines doing that, or 30 Funa Bombs chapters. A bunch of them were in Manila, which is such a giant city, it's unbelievable. And then I just got an email from like Mexico City Funa Bombs about their action in, how they fed this the Monsanto protest in Mexico City, and it was huge, the photos and stuff. So they were feeding hundreds of people. It's just incredible. And I got calls from all over the world and emails from all over the world of Funa Bombs providing free, not GMO, free food at actions and every corner of the world on the 25th. That's just amazing. So there could be a possibility, because I emailed in a press release about the action in Taos, and it turned out it got sent to the chief of police. So there's it could be that that's where the problem is, because the chief of police called me asking if we needed an escort or something at the march, and I promised him that everything was cool. And then the next week we get notice that you know, we're in violation for not having proper permits and stuff. And it turned out that that chief of police happened to be the former chief of police of Flagstaff, Arizona, and they were busting Funa Bombs there for not having a permit for their banner at their meals, and they kept confiscating their banner.
Do the groups then go try and get these permits?
There was no way to get it. You know, there was no such permit available for a banner. And now in Taos, we could probably apply for a permit and stuff, but my experience of that is that they just never give you the permit. And then they go, well, you're sharing food without this permit you asked for. You have to stop until you get the permit. And then you, like, you never get the permit. And so you stop, and it's like 10 years later, you go,
hey, Occupy here got a permit, because they were already occupying. But then it only gave them a few, you know, another week or two before they had to get out of there.
Yeah, that's the problem. It's better to
not have it. Well, you don't need a permit for free speech activities.
Correct,
period,
right.
On a public forum.
Right, and if you, if you're, and it makes sense, because if you had to ask permission to protest the government, why would the government
would
give you permission to, you know, they're not going to do it. So, it doesn't make any sense. It's really insane. So, it's quite a thing. So I don't know what's going on. Maybe the being bothered in Taos is just about Monsanto protest, and or could it be a larger thing?
Is it happening to other activists, like you said?
Well, the only other Funa Bombs chapter currently having problems is Gainesville, Florida. Funa Bombs was threatened by the the police came to their house and threatened to shut them down, and told them they had to get permits to environmental health permits for cooking at their house. And stuff. So those are now right after Occupy, there were this wave of cities passing laws against serving food outside, and they ran the same. It was interesting because in Orlando, when they started to bust us, there was a letter in the op-ed piece that was published and signed by Salvation Army and all the other funded food organizations in town, saying that it was not right to share food outside, and that you should, and that groups like Salvation Army offer real hope for the poor because they direct you towards jobs and stuff like that. So then they made the same law banning Funa Bombs in Houston, and we found out because that same letter basically was published in the Houston Chronicle saying that it was wrong to feed people outside and so on. And then Philadelphia banned Funa Bombs. And then Daytona Beach, Florida band Funeral Bombs. Pensacola, Florida did. Dallas,
this
Texas.
All recent?
It all happened in
2011,
right after the Occupy. And it turned out by accident, a couple of times, different city officials, and particularly in Philadelphia, the head of environmental health there testifying against Food Not Bomb said, well, Occupy, they could have made somebody sick at Occupy. And so I started to realize that it was the 50 cities that banned Food Not Bombs or limited us were cities that were...
large occupies.
You have occupies, and that their idea by making a law against sharing food outside
to stop all future occupies.
Yeah, it would stop Occupy in the future. Yeah, because you'd have to have a kitchen outside to do an occupy.
Well, there's the other side of the whole Food Not Bombs that you never address. You're completely irresponsible about it.
What side's that? The food?
The other. What happens to that food? Come on. What about the poop? There is no poop not promises. I mean, these people are eating free food, and then, you know, of course, the cities like here, they close the toilets at midnight. What happens to that free food? It ends up pooping onto our ground.
It is a problem, I must say. Having lived outside in the past, it's a bummer. Like, what do you do? They do need toilets everywhere.
Well, that's the thing. Why don't we, you know... start providing toilets ourselves. I mean, we did it here in a previous protest. Ed Fry had a toilet there first day. Occupy eventually here got toilets.
Yeah, we did that. We put out porta potties for you know, protests all over. Yeah.
The thing is, though, that the reason that the city doesn't do it is because they get destroyed by the homeless.
Right, right.
What they need are guards, and activists make perfect guards. If there was round-the-clock activists sleeping around those porta-potties protecting them...
right, with signs.
With signs. You got to keep that First Amendment.
Right, right. Then it would work out great.
It would work out great. Then when the police said move along, well, I mean, they need these strong chains in order to pull the... porta potty somewhere else that would make noise, so they couldn't really be telling them to move along at, you know, 2 a.m.
Right, right. It's funny. That would be, you know, I remember, well, when Tiananmen Square happened, you know, in 89, homeless people in San Francisco got the idea that they should copy them and camp out in front of City Hall.
There you
so,
go.
So we're like, they came to us after 3 days and said, hey, can you like come over and help us? You know, they called it a tent city protest at
the
time.
The authorities?
No, the homeless.
The homeless came to you, okay.
So because we were serving at, well, first they talked to us at Golden Gate Park, and that was far away from Civic Center Plaza. But then we shared Tuesdays at the Federal Building, and so a lot of people came over from Civic Center Plaza and ate with us. And then on Wednesdays, we're at the Farmers Market at UM Plaza, and they said, man, you should come over to the Civic Center. So we don't have to leave because we're afraid of leaving, and we were having to
take your stuff. And
yeah,
and
we were like having to give people like 5 or 6 extra bowls of food to take it to their friends at the at the camp. So we move over there, and we stay there for 27 days with a 24-hour-a-day restaurant in front of City Hall.
Cool.
And that occupation was so inspiring. And then I was, you know, the way they got rid of us is they said they were opening a shelter. And so they sent people to this shelter that turned out not to be a shelter, really. It was an abandoned auto dealership on Polk Street.
Uh-huh.
And only men could be there. There was no food. There were no mattresses. You just slept on a concrete floor.
Yeah. But they have a time, place, and manner. They offered you an alternative,
right,
so you
right.
had to take it.
That's right. So then, but then I was at this protest in Cancun, and there was a bunch of us there were like, kind of aggravated because there was an official union that connected to the PRI party, the political party, the PRI, and they would kind of manipulate events so that it was, you know, it was all staged and stuff. So as soon as you were about to breach the wall to, you know, to get into the WTO, they go, okay, we did a great job today, let's all go home and stuff like that, right? And it was all kind of crazy. So we're having this meeting and we're saying, man, we should do this, we should like decentralize these anti-globalization protests and have like set up camps all over the country and camp out and then make a model community with libraries and kitchens and
exactly,
stuff.
Exactly, yeah.
And just stay there for a long time because that would have more impact than these one-off big spectacles like the WTO in Seattle.
Well, it demonstrates a real alternative rather than just a demonstration.
Correct, and be there for a long time because it would apply more political pressure by doing it. It would have more impact.
I mean, all oppression starts with the land because I mean, they take it by force and then charge you to live on it.
Yeah, yeah. So that's a, you know, we made a website back then called consensus.net, tentcity.html, and advocate, and we had photos from past occupations like the Bonus March and in the Great Depression and in Washington D.C., which had huge pressure on the government, and eventually MacArthur.
Is that the Smedley Butler?
And they shot into the
These were veterans,
World War One veterans, and they burned the thing down, and I think they killed 27 people in that.
Because that is the most threatening thing to the kind of oppression we live under is because, they want to charge you for the land that we all own by our birthright.
Right, right, yeah.
And they didn't produce it, you know. Why are they getting a bunch of money for that?
Right. And no, and the fact that you're being there, your presence being there for so long.
And it's very visible, too,
And the people walk by, and they, I mean, the energy of that was amazing. I was, like I say, I was at Zuccotti Park for a while. I was at McPherson and Freedom Plaza. I was outside of the, you know, I stayed at a lot of Occupies. It was so inspiring. But you can also tell that a pattern of disruption was happening nationwide because I would get a call from a Food Not Bombs activist in Seattle and then another one in Florida and another person from San Diego and a person from Minneapolis, and they all would be saying the same thing, going, wow, you know, they're smearing us, saying that that the homeless, that we have to stop feeding the homeless because it's not appropriate. And there was an article in the New York Times saying that we were against feeding the homeless and stuff. And they're going, what? That's crazy. We know all these homeless people we're feeding. We would never not feed them. That's what the whole purpose of protest is. Yeah. And then there was the molesting the girls thing happened, where I happened to be at an Occupy and these old guys arrived and pushed these teenage girls out onto the Occupy. And they said, oh, my God, these guys are grabbing us and groping us. Can you get us home? And so we, like, are getting them back to their – this was in Tucson. We're trying to get them back to their house in Phoenix. And then the media has a thing, oh, girls molested at Occupy Tucson. It was like, no, they weren't. We were the ones trying to get them back to their homes.
Yeah.
And that turned out to happen all over America the same week. So they use this pattern –
the same technique. They all copy it. All the cities do it.
It was all, and it had to be coordinated. There's no way that you would have a national
fusion thing.
It was just through the FBI and Homeland Security. And then when we got those documents, it was clear that that's what they did. The Obama administration, and I thought it was interesting because you would hear the cops, like I remember in Philadelphia, they're all talking about the, you know, oh, yeah, the Obama's funding Occupy, you know, with George Soros and blah, blah, blah.
Sure.
And you're just like, what are you talking about? You know, Obama's doing everything he can to get rid of us. And then it turned out he had had a meeting at the White House of the chief of police's of all the large cities with large occupations the second Wednesday of January on how to get how to make sure Occupy didn't come back. And they were concerned, appears to be, according to the articles I read about this meeting, that they didn't want, you know, the meme for the Democratic Party in the election was that Obama and the Democrats did all this great work, so now the economy was back.
Mm-hmm.
And if you had Occupies happening all over America, then that story would not sound plausible.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So they, Obama administration and the Democratic Party had to do whatever they could. And that's why it was particularly rough in towns like Oakland and, you know, and us and democratically controlled towns because the Democratic Party was the, you know, the Republicans liked the Occupies because it showed the failure of the Obama administration and the Democrats. And the Democrats were like, and that's why the Democrats organized that thing called the 99% Spring. And when you joined that, it turned out that you were really trying to get Obama reelected, and that's what the whole thing was. And so all the people that went to 99% Spring ended up, when they found out it was just a scam to get Obama elected, all just wandered off. And then you had that stuff with Cleveland Food Not Bombs, where they the informant and an FBI agent and a former felon, were able to convince a couple of the young Food Not Bombs kids to try to bomb a bridge in Cleveland on May Day. And then they there was like black box done, and they kind of, and then a rumor that anthrax was mailed to people and Bloomberg and bankers in New York. So they did that.
And the little kids getting molested in Pennsylvania.
Yeah, there was a whole big story on May Day about how violent the Occupy was on May Day, so we better all quit, you know. It was pretty interesting.
Well, what I just got in on the tail end of this.
What have you been doing, Coral?
Yeah, I've been negotiating. We're having an article published about our 18th anniversary coming up in the
that's
Good Times.
So you're talking to a reporter, huh?
Yeah.
That's beautiful.
They didn't hear that Keith is in town yet.
We're keeping it secret.
Yeah, don't let people know that.
Yeah.
That's why he's on our show instead of one of the more listened to shows.
Yeah, we're seeing how long it takes till the Norse Khan regime comes through.
Yeah,
he goes to sleep early.
Oh my God, really? I missed.
Well,
that.
He was wondering if he's going to have a meeting tomorrow. I just read his email.
Oh, okay.
Yes, Robert. I guess that some people will want to come because it's at 2 o'clock and it's Sambrosa.
Oh, the Huff meeting.
Huff meeting. Yeah.
How cool! A Huff meeting.
I won't be there to harass him.
I haven't been to one of those in a long time.
So where was one of your favorite Food Not Bombs in the world, Keith?
Oh, wow. Favorite Food Not
Maybe
Bombs.
Maybe top five.
There's pressure.
Okay, well, one that I really was inspired to see, I'm not sure it's still happening, unfortunately, but it may still be happening, and that is the Reykjavik Iceland Food Not Bombs. And
yeah.
When I was at that, it was right at the tail end of what had become a campaign to oust the government. And the government resigned when I was there. And the local news was saying that people had arrived at the Food Not Bombs table thinking at first that it was weird that no one's really homeless and hungry in Iceland. But then a few months into, or actually a year into Food Not Bombs showing up every Saturday, people were reading the banners and the signs and the flyers and decided, yeah, we should do something about this corrupt government. So they marched from the Food Not Bombs meal to the Parliament building one Saturday. And they decided the next Saturday to do the same thing. So every Saturday, people would come eat at Food Not Bombs, have a big discussion, and then march to the Parliament building. And eventually, the government resigned. The protest got so huge, people were arrested. It was a completely unusual thing. Mm-hmm. And then they started using crowdsourcing to rewrite the Constitution and stuff like that. And they had two referendums to vote to to bail out the banks first before the people, and they were rejected.
Yeah, so only the bankers had to leave the country. Or
yeah, they had to leave the country.
Wanted criminals.
Yeah,
that's what we should have done. And then they Iceland just said, fuck you to everybody they owed money.
Yeah, yeah, they just blew off the Bank of Britain and the mm-hmm. and Danish banks. Yeah,
and their economy is booming because they did that.
Correct.
We should have done that.
Yeah, yeah, it was totally made a lot of sense. And so that was one really inspiring one. And then the groups, well, Jakarta Food Not Bombs was unbelievable. I couldn't believe their food was amazing. So they did two things, Coral, that were so fascinating. One is, besides, they used...
Jakarta?
Yeah, they were doing organic, you know, they were making, so when I cooked with them, they had this recipe where they smashed garlic and coriander seeds together, added corn, cabbage, and carrots, grated, and then they mixed it with, just with flour, and they made these little, fried hundreds of these little patties with that in it. Was so tasty. People loved it. Then they had all these other courses that they made. And then for plates, we took this kind of paper that was sort of waxy and folded it in this special way to make a plate. And we had hundreds of these little plates. And then we go down to downtown Jakarta across from the downtown McDonald's. And
get it away right in front of a McDonald's.
Yeah, and they have brought a video machine. And they showed all these movies. They
had stuff like that, Octopi. It never really got used much.
Oh, it was incredible. And so we're like at the downtown train station, and they had an art show that was against the... They were trying, you know, in Indonesia, they're trying to get rid of traditional markets and traditional foods, which is really insane.
You could bring in American corporate food.
Yeah, to bring in corporate stuff. And so they had a whole... photo show of what it was like at the train station before the government came and gutted it, and what all the beautiful crafts and foods that were being sold there. It was unbelievable. And then I gave
that's
a presentation.
That's a people's market. You know, it's like, you notice how that's what the corporates first go after is the markets that pre-exist and stuff, and try and get rid of them.
Yeah.
So that's what we should be creating, our own markets, and fuck the corporations.
Yeah, right. I know. We should be downtown, like having our own little stalls and our own infrastructure.
And then we don't pay for those stalls, not
right.
$30 for a day. Or
right.
Just, it's free.
You get permission and all that, right.
Yeah, it's just fucking free. You can go and sell your own stuff and create your own economy. You don't have to be plugged into the rest of the whole system at all.
So, yeah, I think some of that Funabombs is just amazing. Some of the Manila Funabombs are amazing. Mexico, well, Monterey Funabombs in Monterey, Mexico is intense, man. We did the same thing. They did a video. There was riots against the inauguration in Mexico City, and hundreds of people were jailed, and they were trying to get them out of jail. And they had, like, this whole, like, wall of... they had two, like, kind of... I don't know, you would almost call them banners or something, but one was the principles of Food Not Bombs and why we were doing it and what was going on. It was this whole elaborate wall of that. It was actually all this documents that were somehow attached to used bags of rice and all sewed together, so it made this huge display. It was really cool, and it just hung on the wall. They had it so it would hang up in the downtown business district. Well, first we did it like for 3 hours outside the downtown hospital, and then we went to the business district, and when it got dark, served even more food, and then showed videos of the protests against the inauguration, and then had speeches on why we need to get these people out of prison and why the government should be forced out of power, and why, you know, why there shouldn't be NAFTA and WTO and all that. It was just amazing. And there was a huge, huge crowd showed up, and they're all sitting there eating the Food Not Bombs food while they're watching these movies and listening to the activists denounce the way society's organized. So, and also, you know, offering alternatives. It was just incredible. And but it is really hard to say which Food Not Bombs is the best, but some of these are just amazing.
Well, how about, like, effective tactics? We were talking how some cities will learn how to repress and then copy other cities. As activists, we can do the same thing. So activists are more effective in certain cities with certain techniques, but we don't have the sharing and...
Well, I agree. Now, one of the things when you look at analyze what doesn't go well with the Food Not Bombs and how it's not as powerful... there's been a whole host of chapters that have stopped bringing banners and literatures to their meals. And I will regularly get calls from people saying, we went to Food Not Bombs, but it was just a church group there.
Mm-hmm.
Because there'd be no recognizable information about it. And
so
if
you need
just,
to have the leaflets and the banners.
And the banners, yeah. Otherwise, people just don't know why you showed up. And their assumption in America, if you see some people handing out free food, you think it's a church.
Mm-hmm.
Another problem that I've seen is... like in Portland, Oregon, that chapter used to share food to about 200 to 300 people 7 days a week.
Mm-hmm.
But they were downtown near Burnside Bridge and other places like that. They were at from 5 to 7 every day. And they reached all these people. But then they moved it to like 3 in the afternoon, I think it was. And they moved to this little park called Colonel Sumner's Park. And they set up in the very center of the park, where there were no sidewalks or paths or anything. And it's a little neighborhood park, so there's nobody there anyway at this park, unless they're there for specifically to play soccer or something like that. And then they had no banner and literature. And so when I finally found them, they were like, how do we get people to come to eat? No one comes to eat at our group. And I said, well, you need to identify, because if you enter this park and you see these 10 people over here, you just think they're some friends
it's a picnic.
That are just having a picnic. So To me, the
location's everything, just like with retail, right? Location.
Correct. And you know, I often will suggest, like, a McDonald's can be a great place to share food.
Because the poor are going there to eat anyways. And, hey, I can save a couple bucks.
Right, right. Yeah, and also, McDonald's does millions of dollars of research to find out where the most visible location is.
Exactly.
Right? So just use their information.
Exactly.
So that can be very, very valuable.
And that's a great little tactic right there. You know, just look for a McDonald's, set up Food Not Bombs right next door.
Yeah, absolutely, because it's where the cheapest food
that's
is.
It's more revolutionary, too, because now you're going after a corporation,
correct,
too.
And you can
their bottom line.
Yeah, you can have literature against McDonald's and against how the corporations abuse the community and stuff.
And it's all meat there, too. You can do vegan
versus meat. Yeah, it's all vegan. Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, in Taksim Square, where the big riots in Istanbul are currently happening, when I first went to Turkey, or one of the first times when I moved there, actually, we organized a Food Not NATO action at Taksim Square McDonald's. Oh, good night. And
bless you.
Yeah. So we had our first Food Not Bombs meal outside the McDonald's at Taksim Square, where these riots are happening now.
Mm-hmm.
And it was amazing. The first guy in line turned out to be the manager of the McDonald's. He turned to everybody and said, "Oh, what a wonderful meal this is. It's so beautiful." And he had his employees come out and with free Cokes and and ice cream for everybody. It was really weird.
That's hilarious.
But to see those videos now and photos of the riots there, it's really mind-blower. I was living there when Abu Ghraib happened, and there would be these huge billboards. All of activists would make these giant signs with the photos that we saw over here about Abu Ghraib, but there's probably like 150 photos that were shown in the Muslim world, whereas over here for some reason we only saw 52.
Mm-hmm.
And
they got to see all the good kinky ones,
the really horrible ones. Yeah, it was intense. And
you mean the torture? I mean.
Yeah, the torture. Yeah, the really sick, depraved torture photos. And you know, so at Taksim Square, there's a lot of activism. You know, it's sort of like the... So I'm not surprised that when they tried to make it into a mall and seize public space for corporate purposes, that people would, rise up against it. Mm-hmm. So that, you know, that's...
Where is this again?
This is in Istanbul, in Turkey.
Oh, what's happening now? Or
right now.
And this is behind a mall?
There was like a park in Taksim Square. There's this one green space where a lot of the marches gather to start before they do the demonstrations.
There's a sentimental value from decades back then.
Correct, right. It's sort of like the People's Park of...
It's like desecrating the flag to a right-winger or something.
Right, right. It's that kind of thing. And they were going to destroy this area and put up a shopping mall. And I think also they were adding a museum to Islam that was sort of this kind of an assault against Ataturk and secularism in Turkey. And a lot of people are proud that
Turkey's
they have a secular government.
Exactly,
right?
Yeah.
And Erdogan has been really moving to the right and
everybody's
becoming
moving
dictatorial.
To the right.
Yeah, so people are... It's huge, the demonstrations. It's amazing. And some people are saying it's like the Turkish version of the Arab Spring. And so that is just really quite inspiring. But at the same time, there's these giant protests throughout Europe against austerity measures. And I saw like an economic advisor to the German government was saying if they continue to do austerity in Europe, there would be a revolution for sure.
Mm-hmm.
And was warning the government to try to, instead of cut everything and force more people into poverty, that they better turn around. But it doesn't seem likely, you know. Mm-hmm. The bankers really...
The story is going to crash the economy. It reduces demand. There's still all this supply, all these empty houses still out there. And it just makes things worse. The tactics they use make the problem worse.
It's
That's
like
why
the,
we have to take government away from them and run it ourselves.
Yeah, definitely. It's clear that the it's obvious that they're intentionally destroying the economy
mm-hmm.
For the average person. I mean, why would you do you know, like the stuff that Obama's suggesting, you know, cutting Medicare, Social Security, food stamps, you know, like, and you're the liberal.
That's what he's not. He's, yeah. he's essentially a liberal Republican from like 40 years ago.
It's right.
Like,
yeah, he's like
pay for teachers, nuclear power cut, you know, social programs.
Yeah, it's really hardcore. So and
then the other sides are all Nazis. You know, the Republican Party's gone even further to the right.
Yeah, and it's a
polling shift.
It is really crazy, and there might be a possibility of a situation where, it's really interesting where it's a. Maybe there's an intentional crashing of the economy.
It's inevitable. I mean, by them putting that money in their pockets, it's less to be recirculated because they don't, you know, they don't spend it as much as the poor and the working class do. So it just kills the economy over time. Because the stuff is here, just nobody can afford to buy it.
Right. Well, I saw an interesting poster. It said 1 in 4 Greeks are struggling to survive. Somebody was holding that, and it was said that in English in a protest in Athens. Well, the U.S. Census says that 1 in 2 Americans are struggling to survive. So we're a little behind schedule here on the uprising point of view.
Yeah,
you know? That's really trippy, isn't it?
Yeah, it's civil war. It's been a little sadly, 7 to 10 years.
Then they just did a Pew Center, just did a poll, and they found that 75% of the Americans believed that there would have to be an armed revolution in America in the next 5 years.
Well, it's coming, but it's coming from the right.
Yeah.
That's how we'll be brought in to help defend the government, just like the Spanish Civil War, against the right.
Yeah, it's like that, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, and who's, you know, I remember reading Covert Action Quarterly, which I actually have a huge stack of, and they had estimated back in the 70s, early 80s, that $3 billion in weapons was stolen from National Guard armories by right-wingers every year. So imagine
I mean, they're working there. There are National Guard people, right?
Yeah, they're the real National Guard, right? And they just take the tanks and missiles home with them. And imagine that those people are so well-armed, plus they get trained by us.
Exactly.
Yeah. And what about the California militia? Isn't there like some kind of police force in California that's kind of quasi-government, quasi-private that's supposed to...
That's what they're relying on, that kind of shit.
Yeah, yeah. And then I saw, like, when in Cyprus, when they decided they'd take 20% of everybody's bank account, they brought the Chinese military into Cyprus, supposedly to be peacekeeping force between the Turkish Cypriot and the Greek half of Cyprus.
Uh-huh.
And the reasoning was that Chinese soldiers would shoot anybody because they had they weren't from Europe, so they wouldn't really care what people were, who they were. And it's like heavy, man. And then I just also was visiting with a guy in Manila who was from Greece, and the new version of whatever they're calling Blackwater has been hired by the Greek government and the banks.
Mm-hmm.
And they have a clause that so Blackwater won't come in and police a country unless they're immune from prosecution.
Sure.
So they, the European leaders brought in this private militia and gave them immunity from prosecution so they could shoot into the crowds of Greeks without having to worry about whether they're going to go to prison or not. So, and at the same time, Iraq would not sign the agreement with Blackwater to give them immunity, so Blackwater didn't end up in Iraq at the end of the war, nor did the U.S. military get to stay there because they wouldn't give the U.S. military immunity from prosecution.
Mm-hmm.
But now there's definitely a horrible covert war going on in Iraq. It's a horrible bloodbath happening, which is... Some elements of the, you know, U.S. Special Forces, of course, are trying to foment that, both in Syria and in Iran. And there's this whole...
money to be made in armaments.
Yeah. And also destabilization, divide and conquer.
Yeah,
makes
exactly.
It easier to get access to oil and
the,
other
it's all about
resources
in the markets and the slave labor.
Yeah, and the heroin distribution to the country and all that. It's really hardcore, that all that's going on. So that's the Food Not Bombs thing, is that...
So do you get hassled in foreign countries like you do here? I mean, where do you get hassled more?
The
in
United
terms
States,
of getting beaten up and shit.
Oh, well, the only place we've ever been beaten is the United States.
Okay.
Yeah. And the only place...
We're the least civilized country that Food Not Bombs...
Yeah, the only place I've been in a stress position cage was in the U.S. I was...
What were you in?
In a stress position cage.
What was that involved?
What they did was, as I was driving home through the Western Edition in San Francisco, I would get picked up.
Oh, here. It's California.
Yeah.
The worst.
Yeah, so they took me to 850 Bryant Street to room 136, and they ripped my clothes off, lifted me by my arms and legs, ripped my tendons and ligaments, and then put me in a little tiny cage.
What do you mean by ripped your tendons?
Well, they would lift me by my arms and legs until you could hear my ligaments and tendons
snap.
Rip.
Oh, okay.
While people were kicking me in the head and kicking me in the side and screaming at me and stuff. And then, so my limbs would be really stretched out from basically gravity from them, from holding my arms and legs and smashing me face down on the floor. And then they would, I'd be in this tiny little cage that was hanging from the ceiling. And that way you couldn't, for the first like few hours, you would try to put your butt up in one corner. And because you want, all you could think of is you wanted your legs stretched out to be, you know, going, you know, if you weren't in a cage, you would lay on the floor and stretch your legs out.
I can't believe you can't
out.
Sue over this shit. That is just...
Yeah, well, there's
you
no,
used to be able to sue over this shit back in, you know, a few years ago.
Well, there's no evidence that this happened, course, right? Because no paperwork is ever kept. And then, so at 3 a.m, after 3 days of this, they just pushed me out into front of 850 Bryant Street. So the reason I know what room it was is they would push me out into that hallway where you stand to go to traffic court on the first floor. And, you know, and then I'd be outside at 3 a.m. with no shoes, no... All they'd give me was my pants. So I didn't give me my belt, no money, no wallet, no coat, no nothing.
Yeah.
And then... so what I would do is I'd walk to the
no
hospital.
No coat even.
Nothing.
Yeah.
And you'd be freezing barefoot walking.
They're trying to kill you. I mean, that's deliberate indifference. I mean, that's shit. You should be able to get millions soon.
Yeah, and they did that to me 3 times. The third time I spent 4 days in. And and my lawyers in that, you know, that was in 1993 and 1994.
Mm-hmm. They don't do that anymore, right?
I have no idea. I haven't had this happen since then, yeah.
It was when Food Not Bombs was just...
Yeah, it's when they're trying to really stop it.
Yeah, now it's too late. I mean, they know.
Well, you know, they did in San Francisco. Food Not Bombs is really struggling to survive, and we did have this one super disruptive guy in San Francisco Food Not Bombs up until about 6 months ago.
Mm-hmm.
He was unbelievable. He was so destructive. No one would talk to each other. No one would cook together. It was a drag. And they didn't have a... there was a guy, when I left San Francisco Food Not Bombs, I became the staff person at the Leonard Peltier Defense Committee in Lawrence, Kansas. And that was in 97. And I stayed there till... that was basically... I never was able to come back to San Francisco to live. But I lost my apartment during that time. But this guy in San Francisco Food Not Bombs started this email campaign that we should not have literature in a banner, that it was all about the food. And before long...
Probably provocateur, right? He's trying to kill the whole political part of it.
Yeah, he did a ton of damage. It turned out also, like 10 years after this, like in 2007, I get an email from Dr. Alan Katz, who's writing a book called The Revolution Will Not Be Microwaved.
Okay.
And he emails me a section of my book that he thinks should be in his book. And I'm reading it, and I go, I would not write this. Where did you get it? And he said, I got it off your website. Well, it turned out this guy had offered to upload my book to the web in 1995.
And he put his own
And he rewrote my entire book. It was really hardcore. When I ended up, the last sentence of almost every paragraph was deleted. The headlines were exactly the same in subheads of every thing. But what he changed, and he reformatted the book, which at the, originally I thought that was just because it was HTML and that's how you had to do it. And it turned out to he rewrote it to be basically like pro-charity, nothing about changing society, none of the basic ideas of trying to do food, not bombs. And so I don't know how much damage
it, basically.
Yeah. And he did a bunch of other things, too, that were really outrageous. So it seems pretty clear that he was either a really disturbed person with a lot of free time. He never had to go to work, he said, because he worked at Autodesk, which I didn't check out at the time. He said that they didn't mind that he showed up every day to Food Not Bombs.
Suspicious.
There was something. And he was super racist at a super inappropriate time that caused us a lot of trouble. So you look back on it, and
how do you deal with somebody like that disrupting the whole collective?
Well, it's been a real problem. So, you know, his influence is such that Portland, Chicago, San Francisco, L.A., Washington, D.C., quite a number of Food Not Bombs chapters have no literature or banners. They set up in the most inappropriate place possible, and they feed almost nobody. So his influence has been quite great, because what I've learned is people would come to, by disrupting San Francisco Food Not Bombs at that time, people would come there because they'd heard about all the arrests and it was really famous. They would see the two buckets of soup on a little ledge.
And just copy that.
And they would go home and they would do the same thing in their town. And that's why Food Not Bombs in Portland is in Colonel Sumner Park. They feed 3 to 6 people. They could actually be feeding hundreds. You know, Sam,
yeah, they do a decent job here, though. You know, they're at the post office. Right,
yeah, no, it's
from
a good
tower.
Location. Yeah. Yeah.
They've been hassled there, but it is a good location.
Yeah, and the way the banner is at the when you're driving around that corner on River and all that, and you see it hanging in the trees. I mean, there's no way you can drive through, you know, through that part of Santa Cruz and not know Food Not Bombs is there. The literature, you know, could be stronger with a table, but at least it's there.
There is some literature there?
Yeah, yeah. They've been having, like, it clipped onto some plastic boards and stuff, and it's not, at least there's that. And you notice people standing in line reading it. You know, they'll even the people that have eaten there, like, 100 times, something will catch their eye. I mean, that's a little tricky. You do have to, you know, change up the literature. It's usually one of the largest expenses for Food Not Bombs is printing the flyers. But the thing you can do is go around to other food not, other organizations in town and get their flyers. Because even if it's not the most radical flyer, it inspires conversation. And it was that conversation in Iceland that resulted in the revolution. So, you know, when the local media said that people read the Food Not Bombs flyers at the meal and it got them talking, and it was because of the flyers challenged capitalism that they decided to march on the Parliament building. So that I think if all 500 groups in America really chose the best time, best location, had a good banner, and had literature, it would have huge impact in the United States. And that's what the State Department was saying in that lecture that they did at the Fletcher School of Diplomacy, was that the banner and the literature was such a threat that it made us more dangerous than Al Qaeda. Yeah.
But also, the local one may form a coalition with Huff. Becky has this receipt thing where there's a law in this town that if you're on the waiting list because the shelter's full, you're not supposed to be able to get a ticket for the local municipal law.
Oh, that's a that's
and so they pull out the receipt. It's already signed, and you don't even get harassed, right? You theoretically. So there was some hope that that's going to happen there.
It's interesting if you you might want to ever go back and read Grapes of Wrath again. But, you know, he's essentially a local
author. It's the same. We're repeating the same. So I do astrology. This is an 84-year cycle of economy collapsing.
Yeah, yeah. It's very fascinating. And the 647 eyes are...
E.
He,
And, it's E now. They moved it.
Yeah. Well, all that whole, yeah, the whole 647, every A, B, C, D, E, all the way down.
All the disorderly conduct.
That,
yeah.
All those laws were are talked about in Grapes of Wrath at different points. It's really fascinating.
Yeah, they're just poverty, anti-poverty laws,
yeah,
basically.
Yeah, just from the Okies.
Criminalizing
the Okies coming to California looking for work.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And the Dust Bowl thing, that's heavy. In Taos, they're saying that New Mexico's having worse drought than
it's coming back. Well, yeah.
From 1904 was the last time it was this bad.
Worse than the 30s.
Worse than the 30s.
Yeah. Which it's going to get worse.
Yeah, it's heavy, isn't it?
It's the end of days. But there'll still be plenty of nights.
Yeah.
You're going to get a constant cloud cover.
Yeah, it's just incredible, this stuff going on.
So it's their last chance for doing their right-wing takeover, because the ecological disaster in a few decades will be insurmountable. It'll be the end of civilization and humanity.
Yeah, Chomsky, I guess, published some interview just recently, or wrote a piece that I saw online that... he was like, wow, the ecological crisis is getting immense, which is obvious if you try to grow food outside in New Mexico. Man, that's intense. And my neighbors are having to kill their cows because there's not enough water to keep them going and stuff like that. Horses, they're starting to kill horses because they can't keep them alive because there's not enough water. That's
and the military and the CIA have already looked at these scenarios, so I don't see why they're still fooling around with this petty little shit. They really have to fix the global warming thing.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
And it's not that difficult. There's biochar, and there's supposedly these, for $250,000, you can get these things that'll take out a ton a day of carbon from the atmosphere and sequester it in resin. But you need a million of them. But for $1 trillion, we could get a million of them, and be
clear it up. Well, also you could start, they could have, I remember I took a class in 1976 called Solar Living, where this guy, the teacher, had been hired by all these oil companies and car companies for future market research. And went in something like 1972 or 73, he went to them with the research and said, look, you don't have any future markets for for hydrocarbons and coal and all that. You've got to move into solar and wind and sustainable, otherwise you're going to kill the earth. And then he went and bought a farm in the most remote part of Vermont possible, and now lives off the grid and grows his own food and stuff. If he's still alive, he was at the time of this class. And what that told me was that all these, his first 2 days of lectures was detailing climate change crisis and peak oil. And that's in 1976. And how he told all the leading corporate leaders of the world that this was the scenario that his 500 employees had determined through a decade of research on the environment, climate, economies, all this stuff. And so they knew in 1976 that they had to completely abandon hydrocarbons and go into sustainable forms of alternative energy. And he even suggested the type, how to wind and solar and all this stuff. And they didn't do it, right? They gave them
no money in that.
Yeah, he gave them millions of dollars. They walked. So they, it's not like they didn't know that they were sending the world into this catastrophe. Because if I knew as a college kid that that was true, and unless the guy was totally lying and he never talked to these corporate leaders and never got the money that he said he did for doing that, they they made an intentional decision to continue to do what they're doing, which is jeopardizing the earth. And you look at these tornadoes, like Oklahoma, the Funabons kids in Oklahoma are like involved in this major disaster relief thing that's going on there. It's really incredible. So they, it's just it's a kind of thing where they've intentionally screwed up the earth because it was for a short time for
short-term profit.
Short-term profit, and so there could have been a train systems all over the country that were run.
They tore those up, the streetcars
and the
lane and everything.
And
so, you can't. I mean, that's what I want to go with. Let's just clean up, get the carbon out. Maybe the oil companies could turn that carbon back into fuel and throw it back up in the atmosphere, because we've made more than $1 trillion off of all the oil we've produced.
Because
energy equals money.
Yeah.
It's like labor or whatever,
right?
For all our mechanics.
But they're not. Yeah, it's pretty insidious.
It's fucking stupid, yeah.
Floods also, in Europe now and stuff like that.
In my mind, it's in the Bible, too, the fifth through the seventh angel in Revelation. Talks about the same thing.
Well, it's interesting. When I was in Israel, you would run into these church people from Texas, mainly, who were living in the settlements. And they would go on and on about, you know, the end times and how wonderful it was, and that's why they were...
Christ is coming back in
a few
decades.
That's why they were in Israel, and they were hoping, you know,
that's
the Temple
Mount.
That's
the sweet taste part of the seventh angel.
Yeah, you're like, whoa, okay.
The bigger thing in the stomach is, oh, everybody's going to die.
Right, except for these nice guys
judgment.
In Texas that are...
No, they're going to die, too. I mean, it's going to last for hundreds of thousands of years. It's not a short-term thing. They can't stockpile, and the Mormons can't stockpile enough canned goods to last it. There's no way.
Yeah.
It's the end
Isn't
of
that funny? Yeah. But they're convinced that while they're living in the settlements, they're going up to heaven, and that's that. And that all the Jews in Israel will be converted into Christianity. And it's like, you're going, wow, okay, that's good. Now talk to the other people in town, and it's Tel Aviv and Jerusalem, and they're like, not so sure the Texans are right. But
well, that's where the big battle will happen. China moves on... Middle East for its oil. It's going to need oil.
Yeah.
It's inevitable. Whoever's the world leading economic powers eventually end up at war. We'll be at war with China.
Yeah. Well, it looks like, I don't know, Putin today said he really didn't send all these missiles to Syria, but, you know, last week he was saying he did. And who knows what's real about that?
I forget. I've been smoking a lot of pot.
Yeah. And then, like, the head...
What's a missile here or there? What's the difference?
Yeah, we don't know where we put them. But you hear these guys talk about how wonderful it would be to have a nice war between the U.S. and Russia.
It's too late for that one.
And I heard this... I've read an interview of a Chinese military leader saying, yeah, our domestic... policies are so bad, we need to fight the United States to distract everybody from the economic crisis we're facing here.
Like, we're the third world country.
That's
country
not right. Oh, and then isn't that interesting, too? Like, all these countries are setting up factories in America because the wages are so low here.
That's right, but the property hasn't fallen yet because, you know, all the rich 1% have been making money on sending our jobs overseas, and then they've been taking that money and buying up real estate.
Yeah.
You know? So
it's true, yeah. I mean,
real estate has to drop like 90% to equal what it's really worth with our lowered wages.
Yeah, or our wages need to go up to like $30 an hour.
Yeah, exactly. Minimum wage should be raised all over the world.
Yeah, I mean, that's really insane, the idea that you can't pay for rent. You know, it's really a mind blower.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. On two working parents... Yeah. Still can't afford to buy. Back in the 50s, one parent, you know, could buy a house.
Yeah, you can barely survive. It's just an incredible amount of trouble there is.
Yeah. That's because you can't get free food from Food Not Bombs. You get harassed.
Yeah.
Or they get, you know, provocateured into these dead-end parks somewhere.
Right.
I see that shit all the time in all these protest groups. Let's go do something stupid, you know?
Right. It is interesting why people would do something stupid, right?
Yeah. Why do they? Is that because of anarchism? Because, you know, I would think somebody who knew what they were doing say, no, let's do the smart thing that defeats the enemy, you know?
Yeah. It is a weird thing that you see this over and over again. And you see, like, some of the, like, there was this huge, you know, remember they had those giant protests against the war in Iraq at the beginning of the war?
Mm-hmm.
And for some reason, the staff people at United for Peace and Justice decided to shut down their office, like, 2 months before the big protest and turn off the telephones. And you're just kind of like,
I wonder
that's
why.
A weird decision to make, you know, so you can't call up to find out when and where. Another one that was really interesting, the head, I had this dispute with the head of the anarchist community in Washington, D.C., and who had taken over the local Food Not Bombs there and was handing out ham sandwiches.
Oh, yeah, so ours is vegan now, but I don't think it used to be.
Yeah, well, it's not supposed to be ham sandwiches.
It's supposed to be vegetarian
or vegan, really vegan. And so anyway, she... decided that Food Not Bombs was not allowed to bring food to the World Bank IMF protest, or they would beat up any Food Not Bombs person that brought food to that protest.
Who would do that?
the head of the anarchist community of Washington, D.C.
They were beating up Food Not Bombs.
They were claiming they're going to. They threatened that.
Okay.
So we had had planned this show, bring a lot of food to this big demonstration. So that reporter from Australia wanted to videotape Food Not Bombs sharing food at the World Bank IMF protest.
Yeah.
And she wanted me to send the website over to her about the protest so they knew where, when and where to meet. So I go on the website, and page one is a policy against the whole front page was that we have this policy against raping one another at the protest.
Well, that's what's nothing wrong with that policy.
And then page two was more details on why, on how we should not have any rapes at the protest.
Well, that's a good idea.
And then page,
why is it so?
And they, it turned out the entire website, if you read it, you're just going, oh my God, what? I guess the last IMF World Bank protest, there must have been a lot of rapes. I don't go into this one, man. They have to have every page. And there was no information of when and where to meet. It was just nothing but information that gave the impression that we must have been brutal during the...
So that was probably provocateur.
Yeah, it was clearly... I mean, why would... No protest ended up happening. Why would you go to a protest where that was the only concern? No information about why the World Bank should be protested. No information on
who was behind this?
This was the head of the anarchist community in Washington, D.C.
Washington, D.C. No, when you say head of the anarchist community.
Well, that's what she called herself. She was the head.
What was her name?
Lauren is her name, yeah. She disappeared after all
this failed. It's so easy for one person to come in and be articulate and just con everybody else into doing something.
Cause
that's what I noticed about the left, whatever, is not a lot of knowledge on how to fight.
Government. Yeah, and it's easy. Well, you know, I noticed when I went to Camp Casey, Cindy Sheehan had called me at the suggestion of Veterans for Peace when she started camping in front of Bush's summer home in Crawford, Texas, and asked Food Not Bombs to bring food. And I really didn't want to go there, as I'm not too into that part of the United States. But
yeah, Texas is a bad place.
I couldn't, you know, Houston couldn't do it. Dallas was being arrested, so I went with my school bus. And I get over there, and I open the door of the Crawford Peace House, and there's this person that I'd seen before that was a lot of trouble in past protests. And she'd come in, and she'd been able to take over the operation of the whole, you know.
It's not that difficult. Because a lot of people don't want to do the work. So anybody willing to do the work can take shit over.
Yeah. So she was running the whole thing. And then there was three or four people, or maybe even more, in this room. And there was a big piece of cardboard over the on the door saying, no pictures allowed in this room. And they were all the people collecting the money and dispersing the money and doing stuff. But when I went in there, they just did not have the sense that these were like...
Real activists.
Real activists, no. And so that same exact moment, it turned out Cindy Sheehan had been called away from the protest because of a health emergency in the family, which also seemed a bit suspicious. And so I went to a friend of mine that was there... was going to take me out to where the protest was, but the woman answering the staffing in the office said, oh, this is great, you came at the perfect time, we're moving the kitchen to a new location. So we go, and we go past the front of Bush's summer home, and there's a big vigil, all the people are there, it's like a really big scene. And then we drive for another like 30-40 minutes to this new place where the kitchen was going to be moved to. Was nowhere near Bush's summer home. There's a giant circus tent, the same tent that had been set on the outskirts of Cancun at the WTO protest. The same refrigerator truck and the same trailer. And we just chose not to use those, that equipment in Cancun because it cost $10 to take a taxi from that location where they told us we had to stay to the protest. So we just camped outside, you know, downtown by the protest. And we got yelled at that was terrible that we were doing that by the same woman. And so then in Crawford, you know, we all go to the new kitchen. We look at it. We go, this is not right. We should set it up over by where the people are outside of Bush's summer home, so we go back there. When we arrive to set it up, one of these people in the room that you're not supposed to go in and take pictures comes running up going, "This is terrible. You're not... Why are you setting up the kitchen here? We're trying to move everyone to the other place." And we end up with a battle for the whole time of Camp Casey to keep the vigil in front of the of Bush's summer home. And they did everything. They broke a truck down on the road to there.
When you say they, you mean...
There's five people in that room without the where you weren't allowed to take the photos. They came and tried to take Cindy's crosses away and move them to the new place. We said, "Oh, no, leave the crosses here. You can make new crosses for the new camp." They told the 2 days after the new camp got started, they told people there was too many people there. No one was allowed to be there anymore. It's like it was one thing after another. It was incredible. The only reference to Food Not Bombs in the media was smear. Mm-hmm. Some guy saying that we didn't have any meat, so it was horrible. it was intense.
You get
like
protein in there?
Yeah, there was
protein. You always get tofu and beans, right?
Yeah, stuff like that, yeah.
What about the garlic? Part. Do you cook the garlic or is it fresh?
Sometimes we caramelize it with the onions.
Because you know when fresh garlic will fight diseases and
yeah,
stuff.
Yeah, yeah. You can.
You cook it, it doesn't really help.
No, but it tastes good.
Yeah. It tastes good.
Yeah.
Lowers blood pressure, but... Yeah.
So, yeah, it was really... it was interesting, that fight. So the...
provocateurs everywhere, huh?
Yes, and it was fascinating. So that same person, she tried to give me $10,000 to drive Cindy Sheehan to Washington, D.C. in my bus. And we had already had a meeting that we're going to go do...
Did you see the money?
No. I told her, "Look, we're going to Katrina."
Yeah.
We're not going to D.C. First, she started out with $5,000, and she raised it to $10,000. Said, "No, we're going to go down and help with the relief effort in New Orleans," because that was happening right at that exact time. So we went down to New Orleans. Sure enough, that woman shows up and starts to take over Common Grounds.
Lauren, what's her last name?
Oh, this is not Lauren. This is another woman.
Okay.
Lauren, I've only had fights with her in Washington, D.C.
There's this other woman that's going all around the country.
Oh, I don't want to say her name because everybody knows her.
Well, all the more reason to say her fucking name. I mean, come on. You think that someone's... Yeah,
I don't have a piece of paper showing that she's FBI. I've been to a bunch of conferences where I heard her trying to suggest people throw rocks at cops at demonstrations. When she lived in Austin, Texas.
Well, now you can't see who she is, or else you'd have to testify that she was saying that.
Yeah. It was pretty crazy, the stuff. And I've known her for I knew her. I started, she joined a group I was in 1978 in Boston. So I've known her since 1978.
Forever, huh?
Yeah. And I would just think, why is she advocating throwing rocks at cops? That's not cool. I know Chris Hedges actually quoted her in that article.
The Cancer and Occupy?
Cancer of Occupy, yeah. Okay. And here she's like been one of the main proponents of use of violence at demonstrations. But she was quoted as being an advocate against violence. So it's like, wow, that's weird.
And you've been listening to Keith. Keep going.
Cool, cool. Okay. Excellent.
I got to find the paper.
Okay, yeah, we need papers. Okay. Wow. So anyway, that's been pretty interesting, that kind of stuff. But,
I'm interested because I think the first thing you got to do, I used to think, was get your own military. But no, the first thing you got to do is get your own counterintelligence, because you're going to get infiltrated.
Yeah, well, that it ends up like clearly a military isn't. I mean, look at like
they end up costing a lot of money. So yeah.
Well, and then a lot of people get killed. I mean,
exactly.
the thing that you see, like for the say with the Palestinian uprising, like the Israeli government was able to pit people against each other so that there ended up being more Palestinians killing one another than, because, or just like the Black Panthers or AIM or any of these groups, you once you have the element of death involved, And then you know, like G.G. Pratt, when he was, when Pratt was in prison, he was in prison based on a letters that the FBI had written. They were passing back and forth to each other, pretending like they were one another, you know, and they and end up in this huge fight. And and it turned out the whole thing's created by the... But when you're fearful that you could go to prison because you're being... You're in an armed conflict, it could be pretty...
Well, like I said, I'm not advocating that now.
Yeah, no. I think that's where you see... you read the books of strategy by Gene Sharp and these other people. In fact, there's another book I was reading that's pretty interesting where this woman that was advocating armed rebellion decided that she wanted to prove that that was more effective. So they started doing research on this. And they found out that that social change that goes through nonviolent direct action lasts a lot longer and is more fundamental in its change than armed rebellions usually, mm-hmm. because the armed rebellions, basically the people that come to power, then use military force to maintain power.
It costs money to run an army, so they end up exploiting just like the former one did.
Yeah, and they just keep killing anybody they perceive as an opponent. And it just any effort at having buy-in by the public for something where they feel it's their own destiny just as eliminated because they're going to be killed, you know? Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it's fascinating.
Well, when I say military, I don't necessarily mean killing people. You have to have some way to defend yourself, whether it's a camera or, you know, some kind of an organized response.
Yeah. Well, that, and you often, in this one book, too, which I can't remember, it's got a really boring name, but they were talking about how one of the key things was to get the soldiers and police
on your side. And you don't do that by shooting at them.
Correct, right. And every time a group started shooting at cops and soldiers, it was easy for the leadership to unite those forces against the opposition. Whereas if, at the UC Davis pepper spraying incident in Occupy and Scott Olson being shot by the Oakland police and the beatings at Sproul Plaza. Mm-hmm. That
propels our side.
Yeah, we were getting really huge. And then the Black Bloc trashing Whole Foods right after that. Mm-hmm. Right, that was the end of it. And it was we had all this public sympathy, and even like the head of the colleges and the mayor of Oakland and stuff like that, they were put in a horrible moral bind. They didn't know what to do. Yeah. And as soon as we broke the windows at Starbucks, they were...
The public goes all to the government side. Yep.
And it was easy to shut it down.
Fucking stupid, you know?
Yeah, it was really clear.
And that isn't always provocateurs, because the one the bank banked over here was, no, I don't think, was provocateurs.
No, well,
and it wasn't violent either.
No, but yeah, and as long as things aren't, takeovers of things are.
But that kind
of
killed the public support here, I mean, in terms of the supplies or donations. On the other hand, the moderates at our Occupy weren't really doing much other than occupying, too. So I kind of supported the bank takeover, but I knew it would kill support in the community.
Well, and it may not have killed support so bad here if there wasn't the other problems occurring throughout the Occupy community, right?
Yeah.
So if there hadn't have been because it coincided with the Oakland trashing, and then the next thing that also happened was they were able to do, you know, like by May Day, you had that whole like bombing plot in Cleveland, and you had Black Blocs in Oakland again and in Seattle, and the way the media could portray it, and it was easy then to say, oh, well, then taking over a bank, that must be evil, blah, blah, blah. Whereas if all that other stuff hadn't been happening, a bank takeover would have
abandoned
probably
bank.
Not...
The one for Barry Swenson's like the 1% for Santa Cruz.
Yeah, and then that would have been the total sympathy for that. It wasn't so much the actions within Santa Cruz itself that was the problem. It was the larger.
That's true. It all kind of happened, like you said, it was synchronized.
Yeah,
by the
it was
FBI.
Synchronized. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I mean, you could have maintained popular support for a bank takeover of an abandoned bank. And that, I mean, particularly that was like a really, you know, to me that sounded like a really good idea overall.
I thought it was great. I want to see a picture of, you know, the vault, you know. Yeah, it says occupying a vault is like the perfect symbol for
Occupy.
Like,
I know. And
I heard they had a lot of sex in there. So.
Well, that could be interesting.
I think that's a better use for it.
Yeah. Gesundheit. So, yeah, it's an interesting whole thing. So all that could have been pretty amazing. But it's really hard to, you know, there's been a lot of literature by well-meaning people and by informants advocating, you know, so-called stronger measures and stuff like that. And then also...
That never works.
Yeah, just people, they don't think it through. There's
But it's exciting for the people that do it. There's that adrenaline rush, and that's why they're involved. They're not really there to make social change or help people. They want that adrenaline rush,
right? And they don't give a fucking enthusiasm.
Solidarity goes right out the window. I mean, solidarity isn't just showing up at somebody's trial. It's thinking through your tactics and how they're going to affect your comrades in arms.
Yeah, and the government, you can see clearly that they have promoted
exactly.
It was interesting. There was an article about the Eric McDavid case. Eric McDavid, I had met in the East Coast, and this was an Outside Magazine article in December, Outside Magazine. And the, you know, that he had come to help with organize the Food Not Bombs World Gathering in Philadelphia before the biotech conference in 2005. And we stayed at Wren's house in Philadelphia. And he came with his girlfriend, who turned out to be an FBI informant. And she was super disruptive at the Food Not Bombs gathering. But in the trial and in this article, they talk about how the FBI gave the informant Anna a copy of Derek Jensen's book, Endgame. Mm-hmm. And the FBI underlined the parts about choosing targets to destroy, like banks and dams and things like that. And they tried to use Derek's book as a way of justifying and encouraging Wren and Zachary and Eric's participation in an FBI bombing plot of a dam on the Sacramento River. And it turned out that they weren't interested in that.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, the FBI had been paying Anna $65,000 a year to find and frame somebody mm-hmm. in the movement.
Yeah.
So eventually they pitted Wren against Eric and against Zachary, and using Anna as, you know, because, like, Wren really looked up to Eric, and they said, oh, well, look, at Eric was really in love with Anna, and you're going to go life in prison for when the guy didn't even really like you, blah, blah, blah. And they pitted, you know, they played each other mm-hmm. off of one another, and they got her to sign a paper saying that Eric was the ringleader, even though the entire thing was created by the FBI. And no plot was even happening other than the FBI's attempt to get these three innocent people to mm-hmm. do a plot that
But it's
never
just
happened.
Like when they sell drugs, that, you know, you're buying drugs from a cop, you're still busted.
Yeah, right, yeah. These people, it was a shame, you know, and he got 20 years in prison beyond it. And you just see that over and over again, you know. People, and you hear that kind of stuff, you just got to say no.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's got to say no.
Clearly. Yeah. On tape.
Yeah.
It doesn't do any good.
Well, as long as you keep saying no. I mean, I got framed for violent and serious crimes in 93 and 94. But the fact that I'd written about nonviolence, I'd been advocating nonviolence, a lot of people could support the idea that I obviously would not attack anybody. You know, it helped. You know, had
I got to quit playing those gun songs.
Yeah. Had I been, a jerk and hassling people, then people might have believed that I would attack Nick Rimmel, the film commissioner, or Nancy Kitts, the right-wing politician's aide. But everybody knew I would never do that kind of stuff. So, you know, it just would be totally out of character. So that really helped, and that gained... you know, that Amnesty International eventually, you know, investigated and saw that it was clear I would not be doing any of those things and came to our support. So anyway, I guess we're about out of time. And if anybody wants to learn more about Food Not Bombs, there's definitely a Food Not Bombs here in Santa Cruz.
And Saturdays, 4 o'clock.
4 o'clock.
The post office on Front Street.
Followed by Occupy.
That's so cool. And then there's foodnotbombs.net. You can find that stuff on that. So.
Well, you know, that's what you do, isn't it?
Yeah, I help maintain foodnotbombs.net. And I do a thing called the Food Not Bombs Free School, which is fnb-freeschool.org, but it's also linked on foodnotbombs.net. And that's in Taos, New Mexico.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's been very enlightening.
Thanks.
Thanks for coming.
Thanks for having me. I hope I didn't bore too many people.
Well, no. We recorded it, and there'll be an opportunity to bore plenty of people later on.
Okay, great.
We'll be running it for
12 years, for the next 18 years.
it'll be up in the archives under Tangerine Dream Team at freakradio.org.
Well, thanks to Freedom, it's on the Free the Land show as well.
Okay.
Oh, wow.
You know,
that's so cool.
Double the play.
We'll put it up twice and get twice as many.
Wow, that's a trip. Well, thanks for having me. That was nice.
Assuming we save it correctly, that has yet to occur.
All right.
And again, you've been listening to the Food Not Bombs Review with Keith McHenry and Free Your Freedom, and I, your host, or monitor or something.
Coral Reefer.
On 101.3 FM. Make sure you come to our benefit June 15th. And contact us at freakradio.com. Org.
Got to put the year in because, like, we will be running it for years.
Don't come to the benefit. Yeah.
I got all excited about a John Malkin show. Oh, things happened. Wait, that was 6 years ago.
I won't work out too good.
It,
how could I even forget to mention?
Yeah, isn't that funny? Because I've made flyers. I used to make flyers without the year, and then I'd go back and look at the flyer and go, what? I've learned to always, and people then, younger people will go, why do you put the year all the time on the flyer? I go, because you got to remember what year it was. If someday you're going to be 30 years from now.
Thanks, you guys.
Thanks.
This is Mauro and the Tangerine Dream Team, 101.1 FM, Santa Cruz, free and wild radio preserve, because baby guitars need a place to play.